This is Bat Cop No Donut for the week of March 9th, 2006.
All right, freeze! Police!
Bad cop.
No donut!
Bad, 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 bad.
Cop, 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 cop.
No, 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 no. Donut, 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 donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
I'm Ron Anisich with your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption. This week, we will use a full program to look more closely at domestic violence committed by people working in law enforcement. But first, here is a look at what has happened on that front since last week's show. A police officer in Gresham, Oregon, was placed on paid administrative leave last Wednesday while an allegation of domestic violence is investigated. The Oregonian says that Sergeant Michael Schmidt will remain on leave until the completion of a Portland police investigation. A Tacoma, Washington police recruit was fired after he was arrested for domestic violence last Thursday. The Tacoma News Tribune says that the unnamed recruit had been hired just 2 weeks before his arrest. He is charged with malicious mischief and interfering with the reporting of domestic violence. Police came to the recruit's home after his wife tried to call 911 after an argument, and he destroyed the telephone after grabbing it from her hands during the call. A former Sunnyside, Washington police officer who is facing a domestic assault charge has found a new job in the Granger, Washington Police Department. The Yakima Herald Republic says that Officer Jose Trevino was arrested last fall after he was accused of injuring his wife during an argument. He was placed on paid leave and resigned a short time later. In mid-February, Trevino began working as a reserve police officer in Granger. He has been working for 40 hours each week, and the department plans to hire him on a full-time basis. The chief of police in Granger says that Trevino will be fired if he is convicted on his domestic assault charge. Trevino was scheduled to go on trial last week, but the case was postponed. A new trial date has not been set. An Alaska state trooper who was arrested in February on domestic violence charges was arrested again last week for a second assault on the same person. The Juneau Empire says that Trooper Clinton Songer was arrested on February 5th and charged with criminal trespass and domestic assault. Last week, he was arrested again after he followed his victim home from work before punching her in the face. This time, he was charged with assault, unlawful contact, and violation of prior conditions of release. He was released into the custody of his parents and will appear in court next on May 22nd. Songer has been relieved of his gun and badge. A Milwaukee, Wisconsin police officer was arrested last Thursday after a pair of violent attacks on his ex-wife and child. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says that Officer Alexis West is charged with 2 counts of disorderly conduct and 1 count of criminal damage to property. West is accused of showing up at his ex-wife's home last Wednesday and throwing a shoe at his wife and destroying some furniture. A police report of the incident indicates that he was drunk at the time. He returned to the home the next night and got into an argument with his 11-year-old son. During the dispute, he threw dishes at the child. He then damaged more furniture and appliances in the home before police responded and arrested him. He was drunk at the time of his arrest. West was convicted of criminal damage to property in January and was ordered to stay away from his wife as part of his probation conditions. He was convicted of drunk driving in October. West is currently suspended from his job with pay. A St. Louis, Missouri police officer was charged on Monday in connection with a January domestic violence incident at his home. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch says the police were called to the home of Officer Billy Coleman by his wife on January 29th. When officers arrived, Coleman's wife told them that he had punched her and threatened her with a gun. While she was being treated for her injuries outside of the house, Coleman appeared on the porch with a gun and pointed it in the direction of the other officers and his wife, who all scrambled for safety. Coleman was not charged with domestic assault, but was charged this week with possession of a loaded firearm while intoxicated.
There was an insinuation on the part of the defense that maybe there was some residual doubt, therefore use that not to give him a life without parole sentence. I think they pretty well kicked that out of the park and said, there's no doubt, we believe that he's guilty.
To think, she said, is it all over? And he said, yes, it's all over, Debbie. So think we're feeling pretty good right now. Yeah.
No, it's not as bad as it was for him the first time. He did not know what prison was going to be like going into it, especially as a former police officer. He knows now. So at least that fear of the unknown, a fear of life behind bars, he doesn't have it this time.
That simply is wishful thinking to try to convince themselves as well as the convicted that he's got some hope. And my message to David Kam is this, there is no hope.
A former Indiana state trooper was found guilty on Friday of murdering his wife and two children. The Louisville Courier-Journal says that David Kam was accused of killing his wife and children more than 5.5 years ago and then calling 911 for help. He was arrested 3 days later. His lawyers plan to appeal the verdict. A Dayton, Ohio police officer who killed his wife last year resigned from his job last week. The Dayton Daily News says that Officer Michael Blake claimed that he killed his wife in self-defense on February 19, 2005. A grand jury refused to indict him in October. Blake was facing internal charges of conduct unbecoming an officer and lying to investigators about his wife's death. He is also accused of refusing to cooperate with investigators. A police officer in Sarnia, Ontario, was arrested last weekend and charged with domestic assault. The London Free Press reports that the unnamed officer has been suspended with pay. Police say that the identity of the officer has not been released in order to protect the identity of the person he assaulted. A Littleton, Massachusetts police officer was arrested on Sunday after he assaulted his sister and threatened her and her boyfriend with a gun. The Lowell Sun says that Officer Jason Triskello is charged with domestic assault and battery and assault with a dangerous weapon. He has been placed on paid leave until the charges are resolved. Triskello was arguing with his girlfriend when his sister intervened. He's accused of striking and throwing his sister to the ground. Triskello's license to carry a firearm has also been suspended. He will appear in court next on April 21st. A retired Dallas, Texas police officer shot and killed his wife before killing himself last Wednesday. The Dallas Morning News says that retired officer Kim Hammond called 911 to report that someone had been shot. Johnson County Sheriff's deputies found the couple both dead on the back porch of their home around 30 minutes later. Hammond retired from the Dallas Police Department in 2004 after 32 years on the job. Here is a review of some of the stories which we have covered on this program so far this year, which involve police domestic violence. In mid-January, DeKalb County, Alabama, police officer Patricia White was arrested for the drunken beating of her 15-year-old son. On January 15th, University of New Mexico police officer Luke Montoya was arrested following a domestic dispute. The same week, Camas, Utah police chief Eric Ovard was suspended for 2 years for choking and illegally detaining his stepdaughter last year. On January 18th, Omaha, Nebraska police officer John Sherman was charged with domestic assault and false imprisonment of his ex-wife. The same week, Lowell, Massachusetts police officer Kenneth DeRoach was charged with domestic assault and battery. St. Landry Parish, Louisiana Sheriff's Deputy James Broussard was arrested after he attacked his ex-wife on January 23rd. The same week, Manistee, Michigan police officer Matthew Thompson was arrested after hitting his girlfriend. On January 24th, Licking County, Ohio Sheriff's Deputy Dustin Burden was sentenced to 4 years in prison for an assault on his 10-month-old daughter. The same week, Wichita, Kansas police officer Gary Tabor was sentenced to 6 months of probation after he pleaded guilty to 2 counts of domestic assault. On January 27th, Enfield, Massachusetts police officer Gregory Scopp was arrested for assaulting his ex-girlfriend. Palm Beach County, Florida sheriff's deputy David Carhart announced that he would retire on January 30th after he was charged with stalking and breaking into the home of his ex-girlfriend last July. On January 30th, Clay County, Florida, Sheriff's Deputy Douglas Elkins was arrested after threatening his wife and other family members with a gun. On January 31st, DeKalb County, Georgia, Police Officer Darius Johnson was charged with beating his 15-year-old daughter. The same day, Elsa, Texas, Police Officer Ismael Gomez was arrested for beating his common-law wife and 1-year-old child. Southport, North Carolina police officer Robert Willis was arrested on domestic violence charges on February 4th. On February 5th, Eustis, Florida police officer Mike Mount killed his ex-wife and two other people before killing himself. The same week, San Antonio, Texas police officer Lori Goss was arrested for attacking her husband. On February 9th, Nutter Fort, West Virginia police officer Brian Thompson was arrested for beating up his wife and sister-in-law. The same week, Alaska State Trooper Clifton Songer was arrested for domestic assault. The same week, Holman, Wisconsin police officer Brian Olson was charged with violating a restraining order by harassing his ex-wife. The same week, Millville, New Jersey police officer Carl Heger was charged with domestic assault. On February 21st, Volusia County, Florida Sheriff's Deputy Eric Kempel was charged with domestic battery after a fight with his wife. On the same day, Robert Bonifant, a Halton Regional police officer in Oakville, Ontario, was arrested for assaulting his ex-wife. On February 23rd, Pauls Valley, Oklahoma police officer Michael Kassbaum was charged with domestic assault and interfering with an emergency call. On the same day, Richmond, California police officer Larry Darden was arrested after he assaulted his girlfriend and 15-year-old son. A few days later, Scranton, Pennsylvania officer Michael Mayer was arrested for assaulting and harassing his girlfriend. It seems as though domestic violence among people who work in law enforcement is very common. In fact, two U.S. studies found that 40% of all police officers are domestic abusers. That number is four times the rate of domestic violence experienced by families in the general population. People who suffer this kind of abuse at the hands of police officers face a unique set of barriers when it comes to getting help. As a police officer, the abuser is aware of the location of women's shelters, carries a gun, and can rely on the professional courtesy and discretion of his law enforcement colleagues who will respond to any call for help. Although the International Association of Chiefs of Police has developed a model policy designed to assist departments in developing their own domestic violence policies, many departments have been slow to implement their recommendations. Officers accused of domestic violence are usually not disciplined harshly, if they are at all. A study of domestic violence complaints against LAPD officers found 227 allegations of domestic violence between 1990 and 1997. Internal investigations found that acts of domestic abuse had been committed in 91 of those 227 cases. Despite that finding, only four were ever convicted of a domestic violence charge in a criminal court. The same study showed that 26 of those 91 guilty officers were promoted by the LAPD, six of those within 2 years of their offense. Under these circumstances, it is difficult to see how the police can deal with domestic violence in the general public properly. Departments who fail to deal with domestic violence are a direct threat to abused women who live in the jurisdictions which they serve. It is simply not possible for abusive officers to provide protection to people in their communities who face abuse. In this program, we will hear two interviews with women who have experienced police domestic violence firsthand. First, we'll hear an interview that we broadcast just a few weeks ago. In 1999, Susan Murphy Milano discovered the dead bodies of her parents. Her father, a Chicago police detective, had murdered her mother before taking his own life. She subsequently became a tireless advocate for abused women. She played an important role in the passage of stalking legislation in Illinois in 1993, and in 1996 was instrumental in the passage of the Lautenberg Act, which prevents people in the United States convicted of domestic violence, including police officers, from possessing firearms and ammunition, even if the conviction is a misdemeanor. More recently, she has written two books, Defending Our Lives and Moving Out, Moving On, in her continuing attempt to help women to get out of abusive relationships. We first broadcast this interview on our February 9th program.
I was an investment banker, and I grew up in the middle, you know, I grew up in Chicago, and my dad was a Chicago violent crime detective, and my father was about 6'2". He was a very handsome man. People adored him, and he was a very good cop. He was a man's man. My mother was about 5'2". She looked like a Mamma Mia pasta label, and she loved life. And growing up, I always heard my father say, if you leave, I'll find you. If I find you, I will kill you. And then those words came true back in 1989 when my mother had finally left and started her own life. And my father was very angry, as most abusers do. And it doesn't matter what you do for a living. it's a piece of property. That's how they look at these women. They look at them as the title of their car or the property title to their home. They are no different. And in this case, as in many others, my father saw my mother as his property. And when she left, he decided that he was going to have control of that property, and that last act of control was to take her life and then take his own. And I found their bodies, and we were met with a swarm of police officers, more than I had ever seen in my entire life, because many of those people had responded to my home growing up. And my father's partner of 30 years said she drove him to this. And I said, no one drives anyone to pull the trigger, and I'm going to change the way society sees violence, because they think that this is with people who are purple with no teeth and are hidden in a cave someplace. It happens to all of us. They do it behind closed doors because they can get away with it.
In the case of police officers, I imagine you're already aware that there are have been several studies done that compare rates of domestic abuse between police officers and the general population.
I think studies do a disservice because studies really, you don't have a lot of people who will come forward. They're so fearful because there aren't services, especially in Canada. Canada, the way that it's spread out, and I've been there, it's been a long time, but you don't have, you're in a lot of rural areas. You don't have services and the dollars to really support this. What Canada does have, however, is they do have, and they were the first in the country to do this, whereas if I was in an abusive situation, I could get my identity changed, get my personal identification number changed, and then move on with my life. And that was one thing that Canada has done that I used while running a national agency for victims out of Illinois that also we worked down in Canada as well.
Is this Project Protect?
I ran Project Protect for about 10 years. It was a high-risk agency, and what we would do is we would literally change their identity if we could. In cases where there was child custody involved, we couldn't do anything because the laws prohibited that. But Canada is interesting in that if a person has a value to your province or a particular province, and they have a skill, Canada will consider them and hopefully take them on as a citizen, which in many cases they did. So if somebody had a skilled trade as a nurse, or they were a social worker.
So you were able to set up an agency in a national agency in the United States based out of Illinois, and were able to help women escape from domestic abuse by getting them, landed immigrant status in another
country?
That's
correct. It was landed immigrant status, and it was a fluke. It was something that had happened because I had met someone from the Canadian consulate. We had dinner one evening, and she spoke to me about why didn't I try to do this and it might work, and I said explain to me how this works, and she explained the system and the process, and we had a lot of victims who were professionals. Some were doctors, and it was a lengthy process. It took 3 to 6 months, but it for many women it was accomplished. And sometimes I'd laugh because I'd find out that they'd be going by some little rowboat after they flew in someplace, and they'd have to be on some boat for 4 or 5 more hours on an island with just 10,000 people. But that's where they were going to live, and safely. It was about shelters. If you think about what a shelter isn't a nice place. It's not a place you want to stay at. It's not. People don't understand. And in many cases, especially in the United States, a shelter receives more funding than a woman's shelter may. And I just felt that it would be better to get someone on their feet or get them on their way by providing legal assistance that would create the safety that they needed without vital statistics coming back at them, meaning if she had a birth certificate, a lot of times they would just redline the information and put the new information over that. That wasn't going to work. Canada had a program where they literally erased everything and she got to start over. And that was the key to a lot of women's lives not being taken.
Women who are abused by police officers face a unique set of obstacles, for lack of a better word, that other women who are the victims of domestic abuse don't appear to face. For example, a police officer will be aware of the location of many women's shelters. A police officer is armed with a firearm.
That right there is the key. He's armed with a firearm. He's sworn to serve and protect. And often that doesn't apply to a family of an officer. It doesn't matter where they live. I remember somebody saying to me that, you know, when I see that car go by and it says we serve and protect, it doesn't apply to us as police officers' wives. Because if she reports him, a lot of times it's seen as he's going to get demoted, he may lose his job, he will lose his livelihood. For someone going through the force, being an officer may be something that his dad did or his grandfather did, or it was something that he dreamed about. And she doesn't have a lot of rights. And it happens all over the country, and women try to seek help, and they're talked out of the charges. What they need to do is they need to, just as you would put the officers through training, do the same thing for the officers' wives. Teach them debriefing tactics. Teach them safety strategies. Teach them things. And also at the same time, each time an officer is involved in a tragic crime of a child or a shooting, remove them from active duty for 20 to 30 days and put them in another type of duty, even if it's desk duty. But just watch the officer. And also have some support for the family, because he's not going to go home and say, I just, you know, found this person's brains all over this area over here. He's going to keep everything inside. He may do what I call hand-to-mouth combat at a bar and just drink off the episode of what happened or the incident. There's not a lot for police officers' wives. They're in the dark when it comes to their husbands becoming police officers. And they're the ones that really have to fight the battle with sort of always walking on eggshells, because they don't know. He carries a weapon. She can't just go to a police district and say, you know, my husband's doing this, or please, you have to help me, or my life is in danger, or he's threatening to kill me each and every night, when he's the best cop or officer on the street.
I think what you're suggesting then is that individual police departments have a necessity to develop a departmental policy to deal with, amongst other things that you've also suggested, but primarily police officers who are accused of acts of domestic violence.
Well, let's take the military. Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful support system for military personnel across the country and their families. Why can't the same thing be incorporated for wives of any kind of law enforcement? Why can't they be taught safety and debriefing techniques for dealing with these situations? Because they're dealing with a constant, continuous war in the streets. They're loved and revered by the public. We respect them when we see them. We take a stand back when their car drives by. You know, we're proud to have officers who serve and protect our community, but many times these what I call cowardly lions don't do that at home. And if she had some techniques, some diffusion techniques perhaps, and if the department was more sympathetic and listened, because if an officer came after an incident and said, you know, I'm having problems, I can't cope, that officer would be seen as being weak, not being able to do his job, because they're still not, it's not okay yet from the top down that if you have a problem, you can come in and we can work on it. And they see the most horrific acts of violence on a daily basis. You can't live your life normally or have a family life without having some sort of a place to, you have to explode someplace. And where are you going to do that? And oftentimes it's in the home.
Okay, you've spoken a few times now about safety, debriefing, and diffusion techniques. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about what those terms mean.
Well, an officer is debriefed when there's a situation and he's sort of brought down to the ground. Emotions fly high when someone is killed. It doesn't matter what the age of the person is, and they're on a crime scene. A crime scene is a very high adrenaline, sort of a speed situation. I mean, you have to act fast. You have to preserve evidence. You're also dealing with family members. You're often dealing with grief and death, and people are tugging at you at that time, and they want answers. So what departments should be doing is, after incidences, each incident like that, they should be working with the officers. After they find out the information, which is debriefing, they should work with them if they feel, it's almost like no different than an officer-involved shooting. It doesn't have to be where the officer actually pulled the trigger, but he was part of the crime scene and the process of the crime scene. And if you've watched all those shows on television, you'd see it, as they are shows, but there are some parts of those shows that are real. There are some parts of those shows, and they don't show the what the officer is going through or what the crime tech is going through, but they have to go home to somebody. And they can't go to their sergeant or their commanding officer and say, you know, I can't come in tomorrow. I feel really bad. So they keep it in because they have to, and they go home, and or they go to the local tavern, and they act out because they have no place to let go of that. And when that happens, teach the spouse or the girlfriend, put her through a training, teach her diffusing techniques to calm him down, not to aggravate the situation anymore, because sometimes we all do that.
Oh, so I see. So what you mean by a diffusion technique is an attempt to de-escalate a situation rather than to get wrapped up in it and allow something to escalate.
He comes home, and all this has taken place, and he's shut down inside. He can't talk. He has no emotions left. Maybe he's angry. He does something, and then she maybe, you know, doesn't know. Well, she doesn't know this, so she goes into it in sort of the line of fire instead of being taught by the academy how to deal with it in a way that could be productive, so that she knows each time she sees this that she knows what to do. They teach her what to do so that it doesn't escalate, so he doesn't put the gun to her head, so he doesn't threaten to kill her. And he does it again because he can get away with it. She has no idea what he does on a daily basis. She has no idea who his partners are, what they are like, what the department is like, what the pressure is to have X amount of crime solved each month. You know, officers are on a, they're on a, you know, a salesman has commission in a way, but officers have a quota that they have to meet each month on solving crimes, on cleaning up the streets, and it's a lot of pressure.
There has been a model domestic abuse policy that was put together by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where they stated fairly strongly that individual departments, as you suggested earlier, did need to develop a policy to deal with officers who commit these kinds of abusive acts.
And in the States recently, we've had a rash of officers killing their wives, their girlfriends. On Sunday over the weekend, in Florida, a man killed his best friend, his wife, and then the best friend's wife. So, and they were all police officers. So four police officers died over the weekend.
With the children in the house.
Yes.
No less. Yeah, that's...
Or the Florida police officer who in October murdered his two children, ages 10 and 8.
There was
and
another...
And took his own life.
There was another case in the Northeast recently where a police officer shot and killed his wife outside of a courthouse before a divorce proceeding.
And the lawyer was hurt in that as well, yes.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that a little bit later, but since you bring it up, there have been many attempts at many levels or to prevent these kind of situations from occurring, but it appears that quite a bit more remains to be done.
The Lautenberg Act.
Well, I was going to mention that in that context. I was hoping we would discuss this first, but the Lautenberg Act is incredibly important because...
It is because it's been forgotten and sort of tucked under a doorway someplace, and they're forgetting to pull it out. The Lautenberg Act was created because many police officers were being arrested and they were being charged with felonies. And what was happening in those cases with the prosecuting attorneys and maybe the police departments is they would talk and get the charges reduced to misdemeanors, which meant that he could keep his job, because in the United States, if you're convicted of a felony, you lose your job, you lose your gun. So there were too many cases being negotiated down to misdemeanors, and it wasn't taken seriously enough. And the Lautenberg Act says that if you're a police officer convicted of a misdemeanor, you will lose your job. But what's happening is police departments, they're their own system. They're their own, for lack of a better word, and I get a lot of flack for this, but it's a good old boy system in some places. And these are the small towns where they don't account for real crime tragedy as far as how the incident takes place, and they document it the way that they feel. There's a lot of officers who commit suicide, and there is no national tracking system for that. Or these cases are all lumped together as murder-suicides, or they're categorized as other types of deaths rather than what they really are. And you see very few police departments in the United States who are using this Lautenberg Act to remove an officer from his job.
So what you're saying is that the police departments are essentially ignoring this federal law.
Yes, they are. They are. And
what can be done to stop that?
I'm only one person, and it's exhausting. You know, mm-hmm. My parents died in 1989, and immediately I jumped into the fire and learned as much as I could, and then I decided to create an agency that dealt with high-risk cases. Either you were a police officer's wife, or the cases were so severe that you were almost killed, and I found a way through the system. The more difficult your case was, the more I could do, it seemed. And essentially, we did, well, I called it relocation. Some people might call it underground, but at one time, we had 300 women in relocation, and we were able to change their identities and do it legally, and in some cases, switch somebody's identity with another woman's who appeared in facial features and height to be the same. And we would, a lot of times, outsmart the offender or the batterer or the abuser. We would have her be the best actress that she could be until we could get her out. And whatever that meant is what she would do until we could do that. And secure the, we would make sure that the situation was secure enough to get her out, because sometimes it wasn't, and you had to wait for the right opportunity. Sometimes that would take months. And we did deal with a lot of women in Canada who had the same situation, but because of the medical benefits that Canada offers its citizens, and some other things that were involved, it was a little bit more difficult to do, and there were times I just didn't understand it. But we were still able to help a lot of women who lived there and brought them to the United States. But that was with great difficulty, and it often took a lot of letters, a lot of phone calls. We don't see this as a crime. The word domestic means housekeeper, doesn't it? It means wife, woman. That's what you think of when you think of domestic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's automatically, it's got to be her fault, she's part of it, so you... By hearing the word, you know what it is. In wherever you live, if you're driving drunk, you will get pulled over, and you will have to go through the sobriety test, and it's about 40 minutes sometimes. You have to go through all the steps, and you have to blow, and then, you know, if you refuse to blow, then you're taken into custody. Why can't they take the same amount of time with responding to domestic violence calls as well as dealing with their own officers? They often don't. It's not looked upon as a crime yet. We still don't see it as a crime. It she must have caused it. It happened. But we never say, what did he do? We always say, what did she do to deserve this or to do this? Why do we blame her and not look at him?
I'm aware of cases where this has happened in large cities. I don't believe it's necessarily always confined to smaller communities or rural communities.
But in the smaller communities, they're less likely to report it. They're less likely to fill out the national crime statistics. They're less likely, because it is a small town, they'll do more of a small town mentality of how to deal with it and keep it very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case recently in Indiana where a sheriff killed the baby, his girlfriend, and himself then. And I write a blog, and I got this pretty nasty response, because obviously the woman knew the person that died who committed the crime, and she was defending his actions. And I get a lot of emails or responses from the blogs from people defending the actions of those who killed the other person because they knew the person. No one knows anybody. No, we don't. We all campaign to, we're all running for office to be in each other's lives. It's not who we are. We want a vote of somebody. You know, when you meet somebody and you want to impress them, you look your best, you go out. It's the same thing in a relationship. The person the woman chose is not who they really are. That person, whether it be a man or a woman, and there are abusive women who are officers too. We shouldn't be just, it's not just one way.
Mm-hmm.
As a society, we become more violent. And we run for office. We want their vote. We want them in our life for ours and theirs. And we do all these things. That's not who we are, and that's not who we will become later. This is saying it lightly, but, you know, we're going to leave the dirty laundry on the floor after a while. We're not going to wash the dishes. We may lick it and put it back in the silverware tray. We're not going to do, we're going to be on our best behavior, and that's what he or she falls in love with, until they let their guard down, and that's when maybe they have children and careers change, and they then can do what they want, and they've gained control. That's how it happens.
With Project Protect, you I think mentioned to me in one of your emails that part of the reason you stepped down from that was because of your personal safety.
There wasn't a lot of people doing this work, and we provided bodyguards for the women as well as I had to have them. I was putting away law enforcement. I was making the system do what it was supposed to do, which was protect these women and follow the law. And in doing that, there were still a lot of people who thought I was doing the wrong thing, and there was that group of individuals who wanted to hurt me, and it wasn't worth my family's life or my life.
Then there
came a time after about 10 years where you can't dance with your past. You have to learn to get out of your own way and move forward. And it was exhausting, and it was gratifying, but I needed to move on at some level, and I did in a very healthy, wonderful way, and I'm very fortunate that I was able to, a few years ago, go back to this work in a much different way because I had been away from it for a little bit with a healthier outlook because I was healthier.
Sorry, I was going to say one of the things you've done is authored several books in an attempt to assist women getting out of abusive relationships. Is that what you're talking about?
That's part of it. I'm a businesswoman now. I'm in real estate and construction, and I call it babysitting, which is apartment rental management of about 500 units. And I sort of incorporate a lot of that in what I do every day, even in businesses. And businesses don't do this, and this is very important. This could be the security guard. But people don't take the time to know people. We're so quick. Technology has made us even faster in our lives. We don't have time. We don't even like when, you know, we have to wait for the computer to pop on. It's not quick enough, is it? Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. That's our lives. Hurry up. And in dealing with people's lives through life transitions and moving, I saw a real need. This last book is called Moving Out, Moving On, which is about divorce and what you have to do. And being your own best advocate and understanding what mediation is, and it's for any kind of a relationship so that you do it safely. And it's not about domestic violence. It's about ending a relationship safely, whatever that is. Same-sex relationships. It could be boyfriend-girlfriend. There's custody issues. A lot of times you see workplace violence escalating, and I'm not trying to get off the subject, but it has something to do with this, because at the workplace, employers need to be more understanding and create a policy just like they have for drugs and alcohol with a safety policy in their workplace. Because anyone can come in with a gun. Anyone can hurt another person. Oftentimes they don't know if somebody has a protection order or an order of protection or a restraining order against someone, and that can be dangerous to the workplace environment. And he or she is often afraid to say, I have this piece of paper, I need your help, because they're in fear of losing their job. Well, what needs to happen is employers need to have an open-door policy about that kind of stuff, and they don't. And that's why companies like Polaroid and Liz Claiborne and State Farm and some of these other companies are working to create these policies and create awareness within companies just like Kraft in Canada. They have a prevention policy. More companies need to do that for everybody's safety. And it's every time a police officer responds to any kind of situation, it costs everybody money. It costs us all money.
But from time to time, I will get an email or a message from a person who is involved in a relationship with a police officer that's not going well, and they're the victim of domestic violence, and they need to know what to do. So I'm just wondering, based on your experience, what advice would you have for a person who is in a situation like this, assuming they're out there listening?
They need to come up with a plan, a game plan. You know, you have a plan, hopefully a strategy for things you're going to do every day or by month. You plan out your bills, you plan out your life. You need to sit down and figure out a budget for yourself. If you're going to stay in the marriage, counseling often is a good way to go. If the person can, you know, is not going to be cooperative, then you have to get out for your own. Being in a violent relationship is not healthy. So you have to sit down and figure out. You have to enlist friends and family, even the church, the clergy, and come up with a game plan for safety. If that means putting money away for an apartment, if that means going back to school, if that means just waiting a little bit longer till the kids are at that age where they can't go to school so you can hold a job, having child care services. In you know, Canada offers a lot of different services for women, but they have to seek them out. It takes work to receive services that you need so that you can go on with your life. You have to have enough income. You have to do it in a very safe way. When you move to a different location, if you're going to do that, you have to make sure that you're on a higher ground floor, that you're not on the lower level because they can break in easier. You have to make sure if you get an apartment that there is an intercom or a deadbolt at the door so that other tenants or people living in the building don't let that person in. Try to let the landlord that you're going to go live at the new location with, let him know that, you know, you're worried about your safety and to take and have some extra precautions. Take pictures with you of the person who is violent that you are going to be leaving. Circulate those pictures. Circulate them at work. Circulate them at around where you live or to friends and relatives who haven't seen this person for a while. Write out distinguishing marks. Put some information together about them and carry that with you. That's also another safety precaution. Let as many people know. But many people are afraid to do this, but it's the only way that she's going to get support. But she has to have a game plan. And in Defending Our Lives, which happens to be in the Canadian libraries, because when I wrote that book, I was on tour in Canada. It's called Defending Our Lives, Getting Away from Domestic Violence and Staying Safe. It's Doubleday published it. And there is a whole safety game plan in that book. And you go to the library, and it's free, and sit there and make copies or write everything down for your particular situation. Because to give a generic answer isn't going to work for everybody because no two cases of abuse are the same, just like our fingerprints. They're all different, they're all unique, and they have to be dealt with uniquely, not the same, here, take this medicine, your headache's going to go away. That's not how abuse works.
Last July, we spoke with Michelle Druyan. She discovered that her husband, LAPD officer Scott Druyan, had been having sex with strippers while he was on duty. She later suffered domestic violence at her husband's hands. Since this interview was first broadcast last year, Scott Druyan has resigned from his job with the LAPD. He was facing a recommended termination for his on-duty misconduct and for domestic violence.
I knew something was wrong when our computer got a virus, and being one to want to try and fix it myself, I was trying to get rid of a virus and started coming across lots and lots and lots of pornography on my computer that I wasn't aware of at all, and a letter that to a stripper that indicated they had some kind of a relationship going on. And I was completely not told the truth. In fact, he denied even looking at the pornography at that time, which was the only computer in the house, and we were the only two people there. So that was actually 2 years ago this month. It was in the beginning of July of 2003.
So you haven't had any trouble with your husband up until this point?
Well, we had some difficulties with our relationship, and it was in a sexual nature, but nothing that I thought there was a medical problem, actually, which was what I was told and led to believe, and I thought it was a a medical reason that we were not having the relationship I was hoping to be having, and that I believed that. I trusted him.
I'm guessing you confront him.
Yes, most definitely. I start realizing, I mean, there was so much of it, and the computer was really new. So I started figuring that it had what the relationship problems were a lot less to do with medical reasons and a lot more to do with other things. And so most definitely I confronted him. He lied. Then I found a piece of paper. I even called Microsoft and Hewlett Packard and asked if there was any way this stuff could get on my computer without one of the two of us doing it, because he was so convincing that he had not been looking at this stuff. And then I found a piece of paper with a bunch of websites written on it that was in his writing. He said that he must have had that from before we were together, but he had written it on a little notepad that I had myself gotten just a few months before, and we had been together for years at this point, so I knew that wasn't true either. It was the next lie. And I just got a barrage of lies after that about everything. So that's why it's been 2 years now. It took me about a full year to find out exactly what was going on by becoming a detective myself. One of the detectives in the Internal Affairs Department of the LAPD said I could match any one of their detectives anytime when I did, in fact, turn over all the evidence I had.
What did you end up taking them in the end?
Just proof that he, in fact, was receiving oral sex on duty, while on duty, was frequenting the nude strip bar that was within his division, him and a partner, using their badges and uniforms to get in for free, and were actually customers during their duty. They each met one of these strippers and started affairs, and it would protect each other and cover for each other, and it was all going on duty. They'd go to an abandoned lot that was had construction, or being prepared for construction, and they worked nights, so it was very late, off of the main highway, and do their business there and cover for each other.
So this took you a year to figure out what was going on. So this puts us in around last summer, I guess.
Yes, it was about last summer. It was the end of August when I actually called the Internal Affairs. I wanted to save my marriage, foolishly thinking that and believing, because then I was told it was just this one random incident and it would never happen again. I knew the second I did it was the biggest mistake I ever made, and so on and so on. And I really wanted to try and save my marriage, so I didn't go to Internal Affairs, and I probably should have, but I wanted to try to save my marriage and didn't think turning him in would do anything to benefit that case or cause, so I didn't. But I did tell him that I would if he continued lying to me, that was the one contingency that I could not live with. All other problems I would learn to deal with, and we could get counseling for all of our issues and things like that, but I would not stay if he continued to lie, and that meant lying about anything. But I then found out another very big lie, which came from the wife of the other officer, because we had started talking by then. I had informed her. She had two children, and I felt that it was a safety issue that she should get tested for STDs. And I had debated for a month, really beat myself up over whether or not to contact her, but I finally felt that was important, that she should, for health-wise, be notified. And so we had kind of had a dialogue and shared information as we'd find out, And this was the last, that was the last straw. I found out that it wasn't one time. It was multiple times. I found out that Scott was the instigator. My husband was the one that had suggested all of this in the first place. And that was it. I had had it. I had just couldn't take anymore, and at that point turned him in.
To internal affairs, you mean?
To internal affairs, yes.
So there had been no domestic abuse up until this point?
There had been one incident, but to be perfectly honest, I really don't even blame Scott for that because I threw a drink at him first. He probably handled me a little rougher than necessary, but I have, to be honest, I had started it, so at that point that was the only real domestic incident. And I didn't turn him in for that. I had discussed it with internal affairs, but didn't want him charged with it because I felt that I really instigated it.
So you go and you talk to the people at internal affairs, and he's charged with sexual misconduct and a few other things?
Well, he had been suspended already. He was suspended, or, well, what they called assigned a home based on the admin charges, which were signing in and out false time, signing his in and out sheets. He had fallen asleep on duty one day while he was in the watchtower watching the recruits on the shooting range. He had fallen asleep, and one day he failed to show up or call in, and repeated late to start duty. Those were the four things. Those were the four admin charges that he was already assigned a home for.
When did that happen?
That happened right around the 4th of July. It was right, we had just gone back from a vacation. And we had gotten stuck in an airport the night before. It ended up really, really late when we got home. He had to go to work the next day, probably on an hour or two of sleep at the most, and was exhausted. And that was the day he fell asleep on duty in the watchtower. And they immediately took his gun and badge and searched his locker. He was actually, they thought he was under the influence of drugs at the time.
So after you report him to internal affairs for this stuff,
mm-hmm.
You're still living together?
Yes, we were. He had left. I used to ask him to leave quite often, and he'd end up coming back two or three days later with all kinds of promises of getting help, of I'll never lie again, I love you, I don't want to lose you, and I would agree to try and work things out again. So he had been gone for, I think, just overnight, and he was on his way back to the house, and I had called him up and said, I don't want you here, do not come here. I spoke to the partner's wife, and I know that you still have not told me the whole truth, and that's it. I can't take any more, and I'm turning you in.
What was his reaction?
Well, he never thought I would do it, so he came here anyways, and I was actually on the phone with internal affairs. He still thought I was making it up. I was pretending to be on the phone with somebody. And when I hung up the phone, I said, well, they're coming out here. I had evidence. I had actual physical evidence. And they're coming to pick everything up and to interview me on tape. And they'll be here within an hour. And he still didn't believe it, so he stayed. And when they got here, they separated us. I wouldn't let him into my home, so he went in, he went to the backyard. And we had sat on the front porch and conducted the interview with me. I gave them the evidence that I had.
What was the physical evidence?
Well, I had a signed confession from Scott. And that had come about with by now. So I said, I don't think that you're telling me the truth. I don't think I know everything. And I'm not buying, I'm not putting my name on a 30-year loan with somebody that's not being completely honest with me. And he swore that he had told me everything. I'd never find out anything else. What can I do to prove it? I said, put it in writing that I know everything, and it'll go in a safe. And if, in fact, you never lie to me again, then you have nothing to worry about. If you're not telling me the truth, I will use it. I will send it to your work. So it wasn't addressed to me. It was addressed to his captain. And it went in the safe, as I said, and it wasn't lie number one that I took it out. It was 9 months of lies before I actually said that's enough and did what I, in fact, had said I would do in the first place.
What happens to your husband next? Is it he's brought up on more charges?
At that point, I'm a lot out of the loop. Yes, there were additional. They investigated internal. I know that they did interview all four parties involved, meaning the two officers and the two other things that they were involved with. And I have nothing nice or no words to use for them because they're certainly not women. But they all four confirmed and. My story, my allegations, and I guess the charges were added at that time. They were first Scott had fought to have them tried separately so that he'd have two separate boards, one for the administration and then one for that, on the advice of his attorney that the union provided. And they got it separated, so they were going to be looked at as two separate issues. Then I filed for divorce, and Scott perjured himself by writing a declaration stating that he should not have to pay his own bills because I am the reason he is not getting paid anymore, and that he's not at liberty to discuss it because the LAPD is still looking into it, but I should, in fact, pay him support because I'm the reason that he was not getting a paycheck. And obviously that's not the truth, but with it just being the administration charges that he was actually suspended for and not receiving pay anymore, well, that made it a lie. That was perjury. So he had to have the charges put back together. He had to have them tried again together in order to make that statement in family court true. And so then they did try him on all of them together, and he was found guilty on every single one of them. I do not know if the domestic abuse was included. It may be something additional because there's other pending things against him still that he's not seen a board of rights for yet.
When did the domestic abuse start?
There was really just one major incident, and it was right when he left. So it was the end of December, beginning of January, I believe.
And did you report what happened to a law enforcement agency?
Oh, most definitely, immediately. I was beat up pretty good.
And who did you report it to?
The sheriff's department, because that's where we live.
That would be the L.A. County Sheriff's Department?
Yes.
What action did they take?
They came to my home. They took Scott was not here. I had asked him to leave. He was at his mother's. So they took a report, issued a temporary restraining order, and took many, many photos, and at the time it was two male officers or deputies, so they came back a couple hours later with a female officer to photograph my backside because I was pretty scraped up and, well, bloody on parts below my waist. It went from the middle of my back all the way down to the middle of my leg. Where I had just basically been thrown across the garage floor and scraped up pretty good and was pretty bloody. They needed a female officer to be able to photograph all the rest of the damage.
And what happened after this?
The LAPD contacted me almost immediately. Within like an hour, it was about 10 p.m., and a sergeant from the LAPD contacted me to see if I was okay. I talked to her at great length because I was pretty shook up and pretty upset and still foolishly wanting to try and save my marriage. And had just told her everything that we had been going through, and she asked if she could do it, gave me her phone number, said to call anytime, and that, you know, I would probably be contacted in the next couple of days to be interviewed for it, which I was. And so the LAPD, the next day, the same detective from Internal Affairs that I had talked to before came out to interview me about the domestic abuse that had occurred the day before. During this interview, he asked to see where this happened, which was in the garage, like I said. I took him out to the garage, and he noticed about 12, 13 ammunition cans, like the Army would have, and said, "What is all this?" And I said, "Scott's ammunition," which was about 1,100 pounds, not authorized. So that's another charge that he would face that he still hasn't been brought up on yet, but that they have investigated, and it just hasn't gone to a Board of Rights yet. I was told that if he gets fired for these things, then it won't even become an issue unless they decide to file criminal charges. But if he does get off, if they were to give him his job back for all these things, he would then face that as well.
Do you want him charged with criminal charges?
Absolutely. He is a criminal and thinks that he's above the law, and mostly for that purpose, because he so much thinks that he has the right to do these things just because he carries that badge. That he's somehow better than the average citizen and deserves some kind of special treatment.
Have you talked to a district attorney or a prosecutor at all at any time?
The sheriff's department assigned it to a sergeant, a detective. She asked me to come in to be interviewed again. I had just recently started my own business, which is from my home, and Scott's not assisting, hasn't assisted with bills in any way, and I didn't trust him to be financially responsible. And so I asked her, I said it just wasn't convenient for me to come there, but that if she wanted to come here or do it over the telephone, I'd be more than happy and more than willing to cooperate, and that did not please her at all. Eventually, she did ask me some questions over the phone, but it was about 2 weeks later, and there were little details. She had already seen Scott and interviewed him, and the things that there were a couple of things she was saying I didn't recall at all, and so she really made me feel like I was lying, and said at one point, you know, how could you not remember this? And you're, you know, and really, I felt like I was the bad guy. And I don't think because I didn't recall one or two details, or at least I didn't recall them the way he had explained them, that I was, in fact, the one lying, regardless of the fact she had two, you know, rolls of film there to show the damage. They're cops, and they protect each other, and they don't ever want to have to bust one of their own. So I don't know that it ever went to the district attorney. I was certainly never contacted by anybody beyond that interview.
So as far as you know, nothing has happened with your allegation of domestic abuse since you spoke on that day with that detective?
Right. Not as far as the sheriffs are concerned. The LAPD, now it was out of their jurisdiction, so I don't know that they can criminally charge him, but he has most definitely been brought up on charges within the department for it.
Okay.
I don't know that if that was included in the Board of Rights with the other things he was just found guilty for, or if it's something that they're doing separately, they don't give me that information.
So after all is said and done, after all this time, after all of being found guilty on these internal charges and allegation of domestic assault and other problems throughout his career, he is still technically employed by the LAPD.
That is correct. And in fact, I was told that the partner, although the partner now has only been accused or and also found guilty, by the way, found guilty of sexual misconduct, that the partner was cooperative when investigated and more forthcoming than my husband. And therefore, chances are very good that that officer will, in fact, get to keep his job. And to me, that says it's okay if, you know, they could have killed us. To me, I don't understand why the fact that they put our lives at risk, why that's not some sort of attempted murder. I mean, just because we are the spouse, it's okay to kill your spouse if it's by AIDS, as long as it's not by your fist. And I don't understand that at all, but he will probably get his job back. Scott, the only reason he's not going to is not for that, but the domestic abuse is something they do take pretty serious.
Have you had any contact with any LAPD officials or city officials outside of the police department about your husband?
Not outside of the police department, no. No, I've called repeatedly trying to get information as to what's going on, and I'm not informed, not that they don't open their arms warmly to me at all. I was actually yelled at by one of the chiefs of the adjutant's office last week for attempting to go to the media. And I said, well, if you guys would just make a decision, I mean, Scott's using you as his stall tactic for our divorce case, and I need some help here. I can't pay the bills. I'm paying my bills, his bills, all community bills, and I need some help. So I need you to make a decision so he can't use that in family court anymore. And if you're not going to make, I mean, I didn't go to the media for, it's been 2 years. It's not real. It's a very humiliating topic, and I would have preferred it not to get out to the media, but if that's the only way to get the LAPD to do anything, to make a darn decision, I didn't see any other choice, which is really why I first started contacting the media. I hope that the other people out there, I'm not sure that this will be as helpful, that they don't feel, that they do feel that they can report it and say something, and even if they have to fight to be heard, that they do in fact have the right, and nobody deserves to be treated this way. And I hope that they will get the help that they deserve.
That is all for Bad Cop No Donut this week. We will return with our usual format again next week. You can send your story ideas and comments about this program by email. The email address for this program is ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to Susan Murphy Milano and Michelle Druyan and everyone else who contributed to this program. Bad Cop No Donut is produced at CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto and can be heard in Nelson, British Columbia on CJLY 93.5 FM. I'm Ron Anisich. Thanks for listening.